Hey, and welcome to the DeviantArt Podcast. My name is Matt Buholtz.
And I'm Khalil, and we're about to have a great show.
It's an amazing show. This is episode 2 of the new format. We're excited to have you all here with us. And what an episode we have.
I know. We have like 2 really, really, really fun directors that are going to be coming in. Oh my gosh. I don't want to spoil anything for you. that's the main thing.
Well, right, let's give them a little hint because they've obviously seen the title of this episode right here.
Clearly.
But we're talking about Love, Death, and Robots Volume 2, which is out now on Netflix.
And you can watch it 7 million times as I have all week.
We watched it a lot before.
Well, I didn't mention that part, but yeah, I definitely did watch it way too many times, yeah, more times than I can count.
Well, you played it cool during the interview. Don't worry. Like you played it well. You played well.
Should have seen my pits.
Let's get into this episode. Like we've caught up now. Like it's good to see you. Yeah, and today, in this interview, we talk with Tim Miller and Jennifer Yu Nelson.
You might know Jen from her Kung Fu Panda trilogy, where she started off as a lead story artist, and as well as becoming the director for Kung Fu Panda 2. For Tim, he is the founder of Blur Studios, which does a lot of animation for a lot of different games. And you might also remember him from doing Deadpool, which was so fun to watch. So
it's a great one. Yeah. And yeah, both of them just legendary sort of like histories, yeah, like,
and super chill people, like just very, very like easy to talk to.
Yeah, you guys will see it. It's a very fun episode, and just they spill all the beans and tell us all the stuff. Like,
yeah, a lot of little background stuff and some barefoot action. Probably.
All right. So without further ado, let's get into this interview with Tim Miller and Jennifer Yu Nelson from Love, Death, and Robots. Welcome to the podcast. We've got Tim and Jen with us. Thank you so much for joining us from the Love, Death, and Robots team. And we're very excited to have you on the DeviantArt podcast today.
Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here.
For people out there, I'm sure there are very few who do not know you. Let's get a quick introduction from each of you and just give us a little bit about yourselves.
I'm Jen Nelson, longtime animation director. I've worked at DreamWorks for a long time. You may know me best from Kung Fu Panda, the feature films. And I want to do darker stuff, so that's why I'm here.
Nice. Tim Miller, I founded Blur Studio, been a animator for a long time in the animation world, and I've directed a few movies.
One thing that I always love hearing when we talk with artists and people in the entertainment industry is what started off your art journey? Like what really sparked that love of art and that drive where you knew that like art was going to be it for you?
Art started when I was very young because I come from an artist family. Everybody in the family drew, and we drew together around the table. And so for me, it was just the natural process of communicating. I'm a very visual person. So really the process of getting into art was finding out how it could be a career versus actually being into it. And so I didn't know that there were jobs doing what I did until fairly later on in school, but I've always wanted to be in art. It's just part of my brain.
Like part of your DNA.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you. I just always did it, whether it was trying to copy comic books or it was drawing little stick figure animation in my textbooks, which I did all the time, you know, little stick figures. You could just flip the books. The teachers really couldn't see you doing that. So it was great. A great way to pass the time in classes I didn't care about, which was most of them.
Jen, what was the moment that you then realized that this thing that you had been doing and something that was so innate to your family was something that you could take on as a career?
Well, it was in college because I thought I was going to go into a career doing, you know, editorial illustration because I was an illustration major. I had no idea that I could really use it in filmmaking. And then a storyboard artist, Dave Lowry, who works for a lot of the Steven Spielberg films early on, came in and showed his boards for Jurassic Park and, you know, Willow and all these films. And they were beautiful. And I realized I'd been doing storyboards all along and didn't know that that was a job. And it was just a mentorship thing of seeing professionals in the field come in and showing what they did. And you don't get access to it, at least back then. It's much easier now. But just getting that exposure was just eye-opening.
Because, you know, it's funny. I've worked quite closely with Jen for quite a while now, and I don't ever remember you telling me you were an illustration major.
Yeah, I would have been like doing like editorial art for the New York Times or the book section or something. Books.
I was an illustration major too, and what I wanted to do was editorial art. Which I did. So, although waiting a lot of tables.
I've never waited tables.
You're the lucky one.
Editorial art does not pay.
Unless
you're like, you know, back then it was like Marshall Ayersman and DBO, and these guys were like my heroes. But you know, you'd get $100 for a black and white thing. But rarely did you, unless you were doing advertising art, which was like, you couldn't, it was hard to live. So I waited tables or worked in a bookstore for a while, which books is my second love, which doesn't really like I thought working in a bookstore would be like the ultimate, but no.
when was the shift? Like when you were in illustration and editorial, when did you shift over into more storytelling, storyboarding, story writing role?
I mean, I was doing storyboards when I was 7 or 8 years old. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't know that's what it was. I'd write stories, I'd draw them, I'd make movies in my head, and then I found out that was just a really great blueprint for, you know, making movies or making animated films or live action films. Everybody would use storyboards in order to figure out what you were doing. It's the fastest way from here to there. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was just something I always did.
And Tim, for you, going from an illustration major, what made you pivot after that, after your time in the bookstore and your time waiting tables? What made that shift for you, or what was your next step?
Well, I was always interested in animation, and that I was a dual major actually, but I made, you know, these really pretentious, dark, you know, films in college. When you really think like, you know, I'm so fucking deep, and I'm having these amazing insights, and I need to share them with the world, my wife, her father is an art teacher, and one of his students had a job at a place in Baltimore. I grew up in DC. And he worked at a place in Baltimore called Milner Fenwick that made movies, and he worked on this thing called a computer to do little, you know, charts and graphs and little animations. And so they said, hey, do you think you can do that? I'm like, well, fuck, it's got to be better than waiting tables. and then I started working on the computer, and it was, and this was back in the dawn of things. So it was a 256 color computer, mm-hmm. super slow. Mm-hmm. You know, the discs were like as big as a pizza box, and they are 10 megs. But I still thought, oh my God, it was like everything. And my love of sci-fi, and my love of art combined in one medium, I felt like I was, you know, moving towards a bright future. And it was, I thought, the greatest art tool ever invented. And then I just quickly kind of moved away from the first time I've told Jennifer the story. I'm sitting at my art desk doing an illustration, my big drawing desk. And I work at night at the place on the computer because they only have one computer. And so I had to take shifts with them. And I reach over, I'm at a place in my oil pastel thing, which was the technique I used. And it was this place where if I fucked it up, I lost, you know, months of work. And I reached over to save it. And of course, there is no keyboard or save. And I'm like, this is stupid. I'm about to risk, you know, weeks of labor. And I just kind of put my oils away after that.
No control Z in traditional.
Wish.
Which is kind of interesting, though. You know, it forces you to do things different. It was funny. One time, Ryan Reynolds was talking about shooting on film versus digital. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know what? Because I'm like, shooting on film, that's stupid. And Ryan's like, yeah, but when you shoot on film, everybody knows you have a limited amount and it's a big deal. So, like, you're on your A game, like, mm-hmm. when the cameras roll. And maybe that's kind of the same, maybe that fear of not being able to control Z is makes the art different in an interesting way.
One thing that I was really curious about is like past projects and anthologies and your interest in them. You did a short, you did an anthology series called Spicy City.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I was, delving. I was curious. I was just curious.
We do it. Research.
Yeah, we research.
Yeah, that was the Ralph Bakshi anthology. And that was, Trek. That was the Ralph Bakshi anthology, and that was so fun because you're working in a tiny place with 15 artists and 15 production staff, and everybody's, you know, young and crazy, and we don't know what the rules are yet, and we're just trying to do something that we actually enjoyed. And so that was fun. I don't think the market was quite there yet. I think everyone's been trying to do this for a very long time, but just trying to get that critical mass of making something and people who want to see it and get that together has been a long process.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like what, and Tim, you're like Thrive. You worked in a bookstore. You have a love for comics. Like your history with short stories, a pretty, pretty long one. Like, can you tell me like where that all came from, where it starts?
Well, I have a love for books. Maybe more than art even. Not that I don't think I'm a writer, because I've worked with real writers and I know I'm not one. I've seen the real talent and I know I don't have it, but I love it. And my dad was a huge reader and he had a big library in our house, and I just kind of worked through it. The Drowned Giant, which is the story I directed here, was a short story book I found on my dad's shelf. It was called Chronopolis and Other Stories. Mm-hmm. And I read it, I don't know, I was maybe 10th grade or so.
Oh wow!
And I just loved it. And Ballard's a weird—he's not the most accessible author, but it spoke to me, and so I've always loved reading, and I can't stress enough how I think that's tied so much to art. Yeah. At least the way I think of art, there are a lot of people that operate from the gut, and it's all about color and form and shape and aesthetics. But I was always more like the surrealist, the idea, and art was just the medium for the idea. I was always a little more interested in that. But honestly, in terms of what this is, it was heavy metal, man. I went to fucking midnight movies at the mall to see heavy metal and Fritz the Cat and all the Ralph Bakshi stuff that was out there. That they didn't show anywhere else. And heavy metal was a huge, huge influence for me, because I wanted to do animation, and you could see people doing something that wasn't fucking Yogi Bear. and it was great because it gave you an idea that, hey, like you said before we got on, it gives people an idea that there's a career here. You can actually do this. Somebody's getting paid for that.
What are some things that you can tell these up and coming artists that our new generation that's now likely going to be able to tell adult stories without like a lot of pushback? What is some advice that you can give them? What is some guidance that you can give them?
Guidance. As though we were wise. We're just stumbling along. We're reacting to random things that happen in our lives most of the time, really. I think one thing that's helpful, because I've had people ask me, like, what do you do if people tell you you can't do something, you know, because they're afraid of walking into a situation where they may not be completely accepted in that role. That's very common, especially when you're starting out. The fact is this something that you would do anyway? Is this something that you can't stop yourself from doing? And then what is their place to tell you what you can and can't do? If you become really good at something, people are going to see value in you and want you to come and help them do things. And if they don't, then that's on them. That's basically they're losing out on an opportunity. But you just have to keep looking to yourself and people that you respect to keep going in the face of that.
I guess my advice would be to don't look at it as a career or a job. You're just doing something that you want to do. And fortunately, if somebody pays you to do it, you get to do it more hours of the day. was kind of the way I didn't have a goal of being a director or being, I just wanted to tell stories. And I, you know, I enjoyed waiting tables. I genuinely enjoyed waiting tables, but I enjoyed drawing more. And so I wanted to do that more, but it wasn't because I wanted to be famous or I wanted to tell people what to do or anything like that. It was really just because I wanted to do shit. And sometimes with animation, you know, you get into these career paths. It's the same with Jen, where it's nice to be an illustrator in a way because you can conquer that hill all by yourself. You don't need the help of anybody. But if you want to do animation on a scale larger than, you know, small films, it takes an army of talented mm-hmm. people, and then you have to have the skills to lead those people, and then you have to have a company to pay for those people that you're going to lead, and you know, and then it becomes this thing that it often doesn't feel like the thing you started out trying to do. It's just a necessary part of getting that journey. But I also think that the journey is the most important thing. Getting there, anybody that thinks that getting there is going to make them happy is, in my opinion, wrong. It's the journey. I was no happier the day that Deadpool came out than I was 10 years before that.
It becomes a question of like, what's next? Once you get there, it's like, what mm-hmm. what now?
Yeah, or just continue to be interested in what, if you're doing it because you think that after you reach some goal, you're going to be happy. It's just my experience. It's not there. You're either happy before that. And honestly, all of the bigger things that, because they make a big impression mm-hmm. when your early successes, when you're first coming, they have a much bigger, I remember those much more emotionally, let's say, than later successes, because they were fewer and farther apart. Anyway, cherish those little moments, youngsters.
So both of you spoke on finding those things that you love and the things that you're driven to do no matter what, you know, whether you're trying to find work and you're still doing this other thing. What are ways that people can identify? What are things that people should look out for that they might be currently doing that could pivot themselves into a career that they could really harness?
I think people right now have way more opportunities than when we were starting out. I mean, so many more ways of being seen, especially for seeing from being uniquely you rather than fitting into like a studio style or something like that. So the thing is, try to find the thing that you really find that you can do better than anyone else because it's yours. And then try to get it out there. Show it to your friends, show it to people that you know. I think most of the jobs that we get are because people we know heard about something somewhere, and then they say, oh, that weird thing that you do is perfect for this crazy show that's coming up. You should talk to them. And that's how people get work. They don't get work by coming through with a portfolio that looks identical to something that they saw someone doing 30 years ago. Because someone that's been working for 30 years prior to does that pretty well.
You know, I was already in the industry and working here in LA as a compositor at a post house, but I had a buddy, Jerome Chen, who's one of our directors in LDR, but also works at Sony Imageworks. He worked at Sony Imageworks, which is a big VFX facility, but back then it was like 70 people. Mm-hmm. And I went by one night to have beer with him, and I was showing him some stuff I'd done at home because it was animation, and I was doing it on my home PC, and it has nothing to do with my day job. And the VFX supervisor happened to walk through the machine room while I was showing him. And he's like, what's that? And I said, oh, it's just a little the project I'm doing at home on my PC. And he said, oh, you're a pretty good animator. You want a job? And I'm like, oh, I'm not an animator. and so, you know, but it's what Jen said. I wasn't like, I had no goal in mind other than to entertain myself. and it led to something, but I would honestly say, if you're thinking about it as a career, my singular and really only advice is just show up, do anything, get your foot in the door anywhere. I don't care what kind of fucking job it is. If you're in the building, you will see opportunities to find a way towards what you want. And I think that's the most important thing. And if everything you do, like when I came out to LA, I did fucking Spanish Pampers commercials. I cared about the color of the urine and how it was represented in the commercial. And I, you know, I had arguments about the color of the urine because, you know, the pink just looked better than the blue when it comes to urine color in a diaper commercial. And so, but if you bring that, kind of attitude to it, doesn't matter. You can't be the guy or the girl that's saying, yeah, well, I'm better than that, or I should be doing something else or whatever. That'll come, you know.
Work gets work. Yeah. Basically it. Mm.
So you guys are talking about all these individuals that really have different things that they excel in and different things that they love. And when we look at Love, Death, and Robots, you guys have built this amazing collection of talent to deliver the anthology. So how did you go about when you were looking at Love, Death, and Robots Volume 2 as a whole, just like even a beginning to approach and narrow down who you wanted to work with on that?
A lot of meetings, Tim.
Yeah. I could only imagine.
When I first started working at LDR, you know, me and Tim had worked together, you know, we had lunch and we like, you know, got to know each other a little bit, but it wasn't like work. Mm-hmm. And I think the first few meetings were just us staring at the wall with just cards of the different potential stories. And then there was like post-its for different studios and directors who we might be able to match up. And we just stare at it. And I'd look at him and go, is this what the job is? We're going to be staring at a wall and trying to figure out this tile pattern.
And having done season one, I'm like, a large part of his job is staring at the wall. And but Jen is great because I had developed heavy metal, so I had a bunch of stories. And then in season one, Netflix said, you can't use any of those. And I'm like, really? Why? They're not heavy metal stories. They weren't from heavy metal. But I had a whole fucking bag of other stories. And now I could use the heavy metal stories, like Snow in the Desert.
Was
part of our original heavy metal pitch. But Jennifer, like I said, here's this fucking bag of stories. And literally, you know, the next day she comes in and says, okay, well, here are my favorites.
Like, how do you, I was always just, I'm kind of curious about like the scale of how many stories you had to read. I mean, to me, that's like a dream. I'm like Belle, just sitting there and reading stories and trying to figure out. How many stories did you have to get through?
Folders and subfolders, each with like 50 stories in them or something. And some said, Tim's choice. It keeps going, and then everybody else had their stories, like everybody in the loft, you know, as Tim was saying, Victoria and Jed, and like everybody had like their choices. They each had subfolders, and there were hundreds of stories.
It was just so much better to find a story that existed that I could look at and go, this story works for a variety of reasons. It works for me, it works for the show, versus hearing a lot of pitches, because we did have animators come in from the industry and pitch us stories. And by and large, I thought they were kind of silly. And part of that reason is there are great animation artists who are storytellers, but these other people do this for a living. They write every day for a living. And if you're doing art, you're doing that for a living, and you may not be as adept at the storytelling part.
And you picking one out of a whole body of work. And if you're looking at a pitch from an artist, that's their one pitch. We're saying essentially, no, it won't fit so many different stories. The chances of getting it right with that one pitch are very small.
Mm-hmm. So one of the challenges then, when you're talking about this, you have these authors who write heavy metal style. You have these authors that write other styles. And compiling that all into one anthology and still delivering an overall atmosphere, tone, something that can fit all under the umbrella of LDR Volume 2, what are the challenges? How do you find that balance?
Some of it is a gut level thing, right, Tim? I mean, some of it is like, well, this story just speaks to you on an emotional level, or some may have a kernel that has like a question that you can't stop thinking about a few days after reading it. So it takes it out from just quote, just science fiction for science fiction's sake. This is just science fiction as allegory, as science fiction, just how it affects your life. Because most of them are a bit genre. That's kind of what we like. We're geeks. We like genre stuff. But it's not just genre for genre's sake. It's genre as a means to get you to understand a concept that may be a little bit off or weird.
Fincher watched one that Jennifer is doing, an animatic one that Jennifer's doing, which is extremely, not the one you're seeing, but it's extremely something else.
Very not like that one.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah. But he watched it like right after watching The Drowned Giant. And he just said, they couldn't be more different in tone. And so he said, I just fucking love having a show that we can have both of these things sitting next to each other. And no, and if you have a theme or whatever, then you're constantly having to fit into it, where I felt like, you know, you can make, it can just be a box and nobody knows what's in the box. And you know what? It the stories that we will have in, if we are fortunate enough to do other season, will be different than season one and these, you know, season volume three. Sorry.
I think what you're saying is a lot of beauty in it, because the beauty of an anthology is being able to have this box of like random things that you can go through and kind of find what fits you and what fits another person. And for me, a lot of art is a conversation and being able to, like, I sit with my partner and watch one, and he might like, I don't understand it. And the best part about it is like, well, this is how I understand it, and this is how I view it. And being able to share these perspectives, which I think is what we need in the world, is being able to like share different stories so that we can understand each other better, see where we're going. Right. Yeah. So
I also think it's cool that if you, and if you are sitting there and he doesn't like it, you can go, well, it's only 12 minutes long, and you might like the next one, because because it won't be like an episodic thing where it's, you know, episode two is like episode one, just different, right? It'll be something very different. Because I don't think you can get more different between something like Drowned Giant and, you know, Life Hutch.
Or All Through the House.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Drowned Giant,
All Through the All House through the are house very is... different from each other.
Oh, man.
right around the time Volume 2 comes out, there's going to be an anthology, a print anthology of all the Season 1 stories. I just want to make it clear that, like, none of the money all the money goes to the authors and the publisher. It doesn't go to Netflix. Awesome. It doesn't go to us. It's just, I just want people to be able to read the original source material, because some of them, I'd like to think that we do a good job of adapting, but some of them, you know, there's differences here and there. Ice has got a very different ending that I'm not sure the author will like as much. Jen will tell you, I'm like a fucking, I really try and stay hue close to the original vision.
So I'd like to dive into that a little bit more, because as someone who, like, I'm a librarian's kid, so I've done a lot of reading, and I've found that there are times where I love a book. It's my favorite book at the time. And then someone says, like, what's the main character's name? And I realize I've never said it out loud. And it's such a thing to do that small step. How is it taking that book and then changing it into something visual and into the animation medium? And like, what sort of steps go into directing that as it makes that shift?
It's really tricky, actually, because there's a lot of stories that are all about the internal monologue of a character sometimes, or there's sections that are simply not appropriate to show visually, because pictures are 10,000 times more powerful than just something you may read on a page. It's just something you can't show. So it's always a process of figuring out, how can you get the core of what the story was? How can you figure out what maybe the intent of it was, but actually explain it in a completely different language?
What made you reach in and say, this is the one that I want to focus on? For both Pop Squad and Drowned Giant, what pulled you to that one out of the bevy that you had in front of you?
You know, Pop Squad was tough because it's not an easy story. It's a hard story. It's one of those stories that you think,
To put it lightly.
That was the first reaction.
But it was in that first chunk, that gigantic folder of stories that Tim told me, hey, this was before I was even on the show. He said, read these, see what you think. You know, it's probably like a little hook and bait or something. So just check them out, see what you think. Tell me what you're, you know, what you're gravitating towards. And I read them all, and they're really compelling and interesting stories. But 2 days later, I was still thinking about Pop Squad. And also, it's one of those stories that I think should be made, but it's such a hard story that I often think of myself as being like a bit of a flak jacket. If someone's going to take on that story, it really has to be me on the show. I wanted to treat it with respect, and that's kind of why I wanted to choose that one.
I would say that most of the ones I put in the box, the big bin of stories, were ones that I could go, yeah, I want to direct that. I just think in that term, I would never, ever have directed Pop Squad. I would never have pulled that out of the box and said, yeah, I think this is a good idea for a 56-year-old dude to do. Drowned Giant for me, was, like I said, I found the book early on and I just always loved it. I couldn't tell you, I'm not a deep person at all. And I couldn't tell you why. I couldn't tell you why it affected me. Or why all of Ballard's books in general affect me. I find the weird sort of surreal world that he paints particularly compelling. I don't know why. I couldn't tell you. I don't think it's like me. His characters aren't like me. I just always found it interesting. And I like just the idea that he never attempts to explain why this giant washed up on the beach or where it came from. Or I feel like if I had written the story, I would have gone, well, once there was a land of giants beyond the sea, you know, and it would have been, I would have felt compelled to explain it. And he just doesn't, not only does he not explain it, he doesn't even allude to anything that would explain it. It just, nobody even questions why.
Yes. That was like a huge thing about the Drowned Giant. Like, I imagine, so one great thing about these anthologies is you imagine yourselves in these universes that are created. And I imagine myself in Drowned Giant seeing this giant and immediately screaming and panicking that they're giants now. Like, we have to worry about giants. And if they're giants, are they fairies? Like, when, how do we?
Actually, I'd like to ask you guys a question because it's tough. We can't get the perspective on it, but do you, it was a topic the other day when we were talking about stories, do you, because of what LDR is and because of the kind of stories that can be there, do you find yourself watching a story like Drowned Giant waiting for the army of giants to walk out of the ocean, or, you know, or another giant even bigger to squash them, or, you know, are you waiting for that shoe to drop?
For me, depending on what individual aspect of volume two, there were definitely ones where I was looking at, like in Pop Squad, I was like, I want to know more about why. And the writing really led it to this like inquisitive mindset of like, what more do I want to know from this? What is this world? How does it work? And you were given those pieces throughout. So you're always kind of waiting for that next morsel. Mm-hmm. In Drowned Giant, I think the writing right at the top, they were saying, you know, this was in front of us and made us question everything else. And I was just like, okay, no one knows. And so then it became this thing for me where I grew up in a very small town and it felt very much like the seaside town. And I was like, you know, for me, it took a very different and odd journey of like, oh yeah, I say this way too much, but like the railroad stopped in like our town and it stopped coming there. Mm-hmm. And that was the vibe of the giant for me, was this like, something happened that was exciting and now it's gone. And so for me, I was never like wondering more about these giants. It was just this like very passing of time sense for me in that one. But you know, then you've got other ones and you're just waiting for that like twist.
Yeah,
you know that like, the twist is coming. you're right on the edge. So like, it was such a great toy box to like dig through and play with watching all of the episodes through the volume.
I think great. Tall grass, like if anybody's not waiting,
oh man, Tallgrass,
he's asking
the beginning,
for it
from the beginning. I was literally screaming at my screen. I was like, don't get off the train. Like, when the train stops, don't get off the train. He gets off the train, don't go into the grass.
Listen to the old man.
Listen to the man.
man. The man said, don't wander. He gave him two rules and he couldn't follow them. You know, I was like, you know what? Leave his ass. Let his ass just let the train go.
He said he would call twice.
Yeah, call twice. The train's pulling off. Also, let me tell you, if I was that conductor, I told you to stay. You know, like I want to know how you've inspired each other. Like, what are some things that you've learned from each other?
I think the sort of level of sort of geek joy and sort of the relentless push for the best through the eyes of a geek artist is something that is really wonderful to be working with. You know, you're constantly going in and looking through the stuff through the prism not of of, you know, commerce or demographics or any of the stuff that you hear about in the business. And it's purely about, is the geek in my brain happy? You know, that's what this is. And Tim always does that. He's looking at things through the eyes of an artist, as a writer, as somebody that's a creative rather than somebody who's thinking of it for success or money or anything like that. First time I met Tim, he didn't have shoes on. He's walking around barefoot in the parking lot. I said, are you a gonna get tetanus doing that? It's so not a business here. It's so like it's an artist-driven hippie commune, and it's really, really great that way.
I would say it takes a while to figure out, you know, how you're going to work together, because we're often sort of doing a little bit of the same job. But you look at some tasks and you know what you want to be. You know what the right thing to be is, but you don't. You somehow fall short of the mark. When it comes to encouraging other artists and working with the other directors, I know what I should do, but I so often fail at it. But I watch Jennifer do it. I see how successful it is, but I'm just not very good at it. I'm just a little too abrasive. And I can see that what, you know, the way she does it really brings out the best in them. And so you can see it's the right thing to do. But I admire that she can do it. I do cry easily, but I'm also an asshole.
I'm right there with you.
That whole thing about the voice thing is that double-edged thing, you know. I could say really harsh things gently, and it goes over well. And Tim can say...
Thank you so much. Thank
you so much.
Thank you. I'm really, really happy to do it. And thank you guys for providing this kind of community for artists everywhere. Great. But we were going to show you some shit. The illustration on the left, you can see, was done by me. And this was in high school. There was a local fanzine. I can't even tell you the name of it. Oh, yeah, I can. Science Fiction Eye. That was published in D.C. And I don't even know how I found out about it, but I submitted stuff to them, and they happened to be doing a story on Ballard. And so this was an illustration done by me very early on. And when we had I tried to get this story for volume one. And we couldn't get permission from Ballard's two daughters who handle his estate. They were like, yeah, we're not that interested. And, you know, based on Deadpool, I wouldn't trust me either. So, but I didn't give up, you know, and I kept begging, and there's a 50 email chain of me begging, and I finally sent them this illustration. I'm like, I've loved this fucking story for 35 years. Please, I'm begging you, let me do it. I will treat it as if it was my own child. And they relented, I'm happy to say, but I think the illustration might have done it. Might have tipped the balance. These storyboards are done by Dan Milligan, who is, I got to tell you, not only just a lovely man, but just if you draw, you can appreciate the beautiful line. Yeah, God, he's
so good.
That use of tone for focus. Ooh, so good.
We did beautiful. I really storyboarded the living fuck out of this.
Yeah, this is beautiful.
These are storyboards for Pop Squad.
Yeah, this is Pop Squad.
Yeah.
And Jennifer did these storyboards. These are her boards.
These boards. To think that they're done so quickly and they come out so beautifully. It's what
she's so
they have to be quick.
She had her boards have a lot of energy. And when like we just looked at something in progress yesterday and I'm like, well, that's cool, but your boards had a lot more energy and that I like your board better for this particular shot. She's like, yeah, I'm gonna get it back.
Thank you so much for sharing those things. Like, that was incredible to get to see the behind everything of Love, Death, and Robots, from early inspirations to the storyboards that built out and the atmosphere builds that you guys have into the pieces that we were able to see and that everyone can see now.
We made some little making of things that I certainly hope we're going to do again to spotlight the studios and the artists. I definitely want to do that. You hear that, Netflix? We have to do that.
Please do that.
Yeah, Netflix.
Yeah, please do that. Do that.
And to give other people because a chance to sort of be out there in front. I really am tired of hearing my own fucking voice. I really do want to have other people be able to show, because there is literally every frame of Pop Squad is built on a mountain of artwork that is beautiful in and of itself. You're just seeing the mountaintop.
We worked really hard as a group to make sure that we could do things that we couldn't do anywhere else. It's a very unique show.
And I would just say I'm really glad there are places like DeviantArt around where artists can share their work, because it used to be so hard. You had to seek these people out. You had a small local community, which was nice, but now you get this world of people who you can share your work with. And it must be a whole, like when I think about, you know, online dating versus what I had to do back when I got, before I got married, I'm like, oh my God, it would be so different. And creative art would have to be the same way, where you have access to just a whole world of people who you can share your talent with. And I think you guys do a great job of providing a platform for that. And artists should feel, you know, it's a golden age of having other people see your work.
Could you believe how much work goes into these anthologies? It's amazing. Tim and Jen are geniuses, honestly. And especially in adult animation, it's like, whoa, this is what I wanted.
It's crazy. Like the amount, like you said, the amount of work, but also the depth of work.
Yeah.
Like you have to know so many different facets of everything that's going on within the process. Like you can't just be one thing when you're making an anthology or leading an anthology.
Everything. You have to do everything. Those storyboards, oh my God, so beautiful.
I can't believe they shared that. Like those are really cool things to get to see. Yeah. And I'm so stoked that we were able to get that behind the scenes with them. Like that's really awesome. What's really exciting is also Tim and Jennifer gave us the ability to run a challenge using a background from Love, Death, and Robots.
Yeah, actually, you can see it right here. You might recognize it from the volume one of LDR. It's from Sony's Edge. You can literally create anything you want to fit into this world, and you can alter it in any way that you want so that you can make it fit your storyline. We'd love to see more of your work. I'm really excited to see where this one goes.
Yeah, so you can choose if you want to do it traditionally, scan it in. If you want to do it digitally, you can paint it in. You want to do a photo and photo bash it, you can do that. Can add in a 3D model, whatever you want. Make sure to hashtag it DALDR. Just the letters. It stands for DeviantArt, Love, Death, and Robots, but hashtag DALDR, and that will enter you to win a Wacom One tablet for your chance to win.
You know how I love winning things.
People love winning things. Yeah. Speaking of winning things, we've got some submissions from the last episode with Karan Kaiser Stone.
Oh, our mouse draw.
Yeah, where people drew with their mouses or their touchpads or whatever. So we're going to start a slideshow right now to show you some of the ones that we really enjoyed.
Take it away.
Perdomo Nicholas 27 made this armored bear, very League of Legends meets Golden Compass. Can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I love this. The inking is really, really great. It doesn't look like it's been done by a mouse. Great mixed media. Solar Biscuit 96. Now talk about meta. This is a mouse drawing of a mouse, drawing a mouse being a mouse, and I cannot get enough of it.
Draw me like one of your French mice.
and Tokyo Moonlight with this very soft, very beautiful like landscape scene. I really enjoy the little touches of like dots of color.
Yeah, really nice brush on it.
Le Cristal gives us this beautiful representation of motion. It's like the essence of movement.
It's so fluid. I love it. And thank you so much for everyone that submitted to DA Mouse Draws. This was great. And that's basically it for this episode.
Yeah, that kind of ends it. Oh, I miss you. We're going to have to separate again.
Oh, no. coming. Through the screen.
It was like borderline anyway. Getting creepy.
that's the selling point. Make sure to like, subscribe the DA podcast so we can continue to make these, continue to bring you awesome interviews with special guests and show you more stuff and give away more stuff to help you level up your art at home. But until then, I'm Matt Buchholz.
And I'm Khalil Jones. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks for watching.